Funding for THINK comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to THINK on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Why is it so hard to get along with those who differ from us, and what do we gain when we push past ethnic, religious, economic, and political difference in order to work together? My guest today has given a great deal of thought to the things that divide us and to the skills required for effective compromise and collaboration. Richard Sennett is distinguished visiting scholar at the University of Cambridge and emeritus professor of sociology at the London School of Economics. His new book is called Together: The Rituals, Pleasures, and Politics of Cooperation. Richard, welcome to THINK.
Thank you. Glad to talk to you.
Does cooperation come naturally to human beings?
It does. It's planted deeply in our genes, although we don't know quite where it is. But from the moment human beings are born, they've got to cooperate with others in order to survive. And in most societies, that early experience is something that's carried forward into adult life and developed to a high degree. My worry is that what we're seeing, particularly in America, is that our social institutions aren't helping us enrich and develop that native genetic potential that all of us have from the moment we're born.
What tells you that we're less cooperative today than we used to be?
It's a long story. I mean, in a way, it's evident, you know, in the political realm.
Yeah.
It doesn't need much underlining. The kinds of social things that I've been looking at are, for instance, studies done by UNICEF of how much children study together. This is it's a one good barometer. The U.S. is way down the bottom of the scale in that kind of experience. Other kinds of studies of childhood show that kids are today in the U.S. developing an early preference for what are called solo sports rather than for team sports. And again, that's a contrast to young children in other countries. And, you know, you can play this all out along the spectrum of social life. It isn't a question of that we're a more competitive society than other people, necessarily. I mean, because cooperation and competition can combine. They do in any team sport. They do in the business world and so on. But we tend to think much more about doing things for ourselves alone and seeing the intrusion of other people as something, taking away something from ourselves. And that's disabling, in my view. That's a real problem we have to address in everyday life. It's you can't blame it all on the politicians.
Yeah. Well, we celebrate in this country this idea of rugged individualism, and that obviously might be a factor in all this. I wonder, too, if you think that our relative affluence has anything to do with it. The idea that from childhood today, a lot of at least middle-class children expect to have their own rooms, maybe their own TVs, their own computers. There's no cooperation required even for daily life at home.
You could say that. I think that makes a certain kind of sense. What it doesn't quite explain is why, for instance, American kids spend about a third of the time talking to adults that French children do, and they're roughly equally affluent societies. We tend to eat much more on the run, for instance. Kids and parents don't sit down to, you know, share a meal together for any long period of time the way kids do in France. So I think it's really, it's an issue about culture and about values as much as it is about cash. Another dimension to this, which I talk about in my book, is the effect of, this is a little more complicated, but I think it's a quite strong effect, is what it means to work with other people short-term, short-term time, you know, working at a job 6 months or a year, if you can get it. Now, one of the things we noticed in our studies was that people who live in that short-term world tend to be much less cooperative with other workers than people who stay, you know, stay in the job together with people that get to know over a period of years. It's not surprising. You know, when you know somebody well, you're going to be more responsive to them and they to you than if it's a kind of revolving door at work. And again, the U.S. has a high proportion of short-term or temp jobs. It's not at the top, but it's nearly at the top of the developed world's work structure for this kind of short-term work where people's social relations are rather superficial. So, you know, it's a confluence of forces. I don't think it can just be reduced to money.
Yeah. Well, it is also interesting because every company would seem to have a vested interest in getting people to work together. Most companies talk about teamwork, and yet department to department, people end up very siloed.
Right, exactly. And the problem with that is that is what we actually mean by teamwork and how it gets practiced. I did a study of this long about 10 years ago about how teams function in the high tech industry. They tend to be quite short term, and they tend to be set almost impossible targets for what the team is going to accomplish. And what happens very early on in teams under those conditions is that people begin watching their backs. Mm-hmm. They want deniability when things don't work out. In firms where teams compete against each other, losing is more catastrophic than it is in sports. Frequently, the losing teams are not only disbanded, but the members are let go. So you get a climate of, you know, anxiety and fear that underlays what seems to be a premium put on cooperation. If we had a workforce that was structured, you know, our workplaces were structured a little differently, if people felt that they had more security of employment over a long term, and that if the team lost, it wasn't going to be a catastrophic loss, you'd get less of this kind of watching your back phenomenon, and you'd get more genuine cooperation.
Do you find, Richard, that most people are aware of the decline in cooperation we've seen in recent decades?
Yes, we do find that. Mm-hmm. When we do studies of whether people, to sort of simple things like, can you count on your neighbor if there's a if there's an emergency at home? There's about one of the studies that did this found about a 30% drop in the number of people who felt that they could count on their immediate neighbors if there were an emergency. I think there's a, if I might say so, Chris, I think there's a kind of schizophrenia about this.
Mm-hmm.
Because on the one hand, I think Americans know this is a less cooperative society. But on the other hand, people think, well, I'm going to do it on my own. You know, I'm not going to be in a position where I have to depend on anyone else. And, you know, that's not a good combination, because if ultimately your view is that it's, you know, all whatever happens to you is your own individual responsibility, you're going to push other people aside, or they're going to feel that they are really not relevant to you, and you know, that you don't really, when the chips are down, that you don't matter to them, you know.
Yeah. So why would you stick your neck out when the chips are down on their side?
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Talk about the different kinds of things that cause people to form what you refer to as tribes. In other words, we cling to people that we do think remind us of ourselves and that we will get along with.
Well, we do. And there's nothing unusual about that. I mean, it happens in all societies. When you get what I call in my book tribalism, is where you blot out the outside world, when it's you and only you, and everybody else is seen as a threat. If we all lived in you know, very simple conditions, far spread out from each other, if there wasn't a global economy, if people didn't need to move other places in their lives for school or for work, maybe that would work. The notion that there's no outside,
right,
and that you can bond. But what happens is that when you have that strong feeling of group identification, but you're in a society where there are many kinds of demands coming on you from the outside, one of the reactions is to withdraw rather than to reach out and say, how do I deal with this? The focus in my book is how people can develop the kinds of skills, life skills, so that they feel more comfortable when they're confronted with complexity, and actually addressing it, reaching out to it, dealing with it, rather than shrinking further into themselves. And I've tried to look at both psychologically and socially the way those kinds of life skills develop. I'll give you an example. I hope I'm not talking too much.
No, you're doing great. Sounds perfect.
Okay. I'll give you an example of that. Probably the most important skill that people need to develop in dealing with people who are unlike themselves are kind of like themselves is a kind of listening skill. It's to try and detect beneath the surface of what somebody else is saying, what they actually mean. Their words may not, you know, register very much to you. Their experience may be foreign to you. If you learn how to listen well, you learn how to gradually elicit something that you can connect with that's not imprisoned in that surface of words.
Let me jump in here. We do need to take a quick break. My guest this hour is Richard Sennett. His new book is called Together, The Rituals, Pleasures, and Politics of Cooperation. If you'd like to join this conversation, call us. The number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Richard Sennett. He's professor of sociology, emeritus professor of sociology at the London School of Economics and distinguished visiting scholar at the University of Cambridge. His new book is called Together, The Rituals, Pleasures, and Politics of Cooperation. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, call us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Before the break, Richard, you were telling us about listening with empathy. Can you continue what you were telling us?
Yes. I mean, one of the most fundamental ways we cooperate with other people is through how we learn to listen to them. If you sort of suspend the fear that somebody might say something to you which you don't understand, and try and understand what's beneath the surface, what words that they're giving to you, you're in a really cooperative situation with them. You're working with them, and it comes across to other people. That is, that you're really paying attention to them. This is what's called in sociological jargon dialogic communication. I don't know. Sociologists seem to invent these things all the time. But the notion about it is that cooperation begins with an act of being receptive to what's coming in from others and not taking things at face value and taking offense at face value. Another aspect of this is just, you know, even down to the way we use language. If you're flatly assertive to somebody else, you say, "This is what I think," you're in a way challenging the other person, and you're kind of foreclosing a kind of exploration of what they might think. Whereas if you use a subjunctive tense, you know, "I would have thought perhaps," all the sorts of stuff you don't hear on right-wing talk radio.
You do hear them on NPR.
Yeah, of course you do. But, you know, that's an invitation to the other you're leaving space for the other person. And the kind of declarativeness embodies what the philosopher Bernard Williams called a fetish of assertion. That the way you communicate is by being as clear, forthright, and definite as possible. And in fact, it's a very dysfunctional way to interact with other people. The more subjunctive you are, the more you're leaving a ground of ambiguity. "I would have thought that," perhaps. A way of kind of opening up a space where you can interact. So, you know, those are the kinds of skills that we need, particularly with dealing with people who are different than ourselves. You know?
At the risk of sounding sexist, a lot of people would argue that that kind of communication comes more easily to women than to men. What do you think of that?
I actually agree. And I say that to you as a man.
Mm-hmm.
My colleague Carol Gilligan has recently been looking at exactly this kind of question about how masculinity infuses the notion that you've got to come on aggressively to other people. And what's so interesting in her research is she finds that when you do that, come on aggressively in that male way, that one of the results is that if you're dealing with somebody who is not another alpha male, you're often confused by the responses, you know, because you haven't taken anything in. You've just sort of laid down the gauntlet. And when they look at you differently, you know, or they come back with something you didn't expect, you're confused that this kind of aggressive behavior didn't produce a clarity, in fact. So, yeah, it is male. At least that's what she's found. Although, as we know, women can behave in male ways and men can behave in supposedly female ways.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phones now, and we'll speak with George in Plano. Hello, George.
Oh, yes, Chris. Hi. Yes, Professor, I wanted to ask you if you feel as though that the if you feel as though the media has contributed to this sense of sort of estrangement and conflict among people throughout our you know our developed societies over the past 50 years or so, like movies and TV and the news and newspapers.
Yeah. You touch on something that I've wondered about a lot. It's people don't find much entertainment value in listening to a discussion the way they find entertainment value in listening to an argument. Do you know what I mean? Hmm. And I think that's from my experience. I've lived a long time in Britain, which is a very has an everyday life. People are good at discussing, but the media is just as ferocious as it is here in the States, and it's a very striking contrast. Nobody would ever think of speaking to somebody they were having dinner with the way they enjoy listening to people go at each other on the tube. So yes, I agree with you. I think this is a terrible problem. Of course, not for NPR.
Well, we're not perfect, but
it's just it's verbal combat as entertainment, and unfortunately for kids, I see that as a teacher in the classroom that they really pick that up. You know, that they perk up when somebody starts to get aggressive to another kid in class, and they sort of slump back with relative boredom when somebody says, well, tell me more what you mean, or I didn't quite understand what you mean, and so on. It's less engaging. And I think it's mediatized, a lot of that kind of response.
Let's talk about this. Our technologically enabled social networks would seem to connect us better than ever to people all over the world. And yet you find that these connections tend to be fairly exclusive and fairly tribal. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, they do tend to be that. But I'd say probably everybody listening to this program has had the same experience I've had of going onto a blog, which should be a kind of, sharing of information and views. They tend to be absolutely, prize fighter rings. people saying, how could you, say X or Y, or I think blah, 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 blah. And here's this wonderful technology that should allow people to really take a lot in that's unfamiliar to them from strangers, to really open up, the way people think, and they instead sort of get very easily closed down into verbal competition and aggression. There's nothing wrong with the media itself. It doesn't dictate that people act that way, except for one thing, that when you don't have somebody face to face, it's a little easier to unbutton all the demons within and be insulting. But still, the media can be used in many, many different ways, cooperative ways. Look at what happened in Tahrir Square and the rest of the Arab Spring last year. That was real cooperative work for a political end that used very advanced technology. So I think it's an issue, and it's an issue, as we were talking about before, which comes back to culture, not to the fact of the machines alone.
Mm-hmm. Does it make a difference, the things that separate us culturally? I mean, you have race, you have ethnicity, you have income level, you have social class. Do they each separate us in different ways?
Sure. And I have a very biased view about which is more and which is less important.
Mm-hmm.
My own view is that, particularly in the States, that class is the most important separation that divides people.
Which is funny because we hate to talk about that. We like to think of ourselves as a society where everybody's mobile.
Yeah, exactly. Everybody is middle class. you know, it's a kind of dirty secret. And, you know, it operates up as well as down. It's absurd for somebody like Mitt Romney to describe himself as middle class. Well, he does.
We would all love to be that kind of middle class.
Yeah. Well, maybe you wouldn't.
Yeah.
You don't need $250 million.
I certainly don't.
You don't. Although, you know, you might have dreams of what you could waste $249 million. But, you know, the issue about this is when you have a difference and you don't talk about it, it becomes dysfunctional.
Hmm.
When you have a difference and it's articulated and people explore it, it's easier to deal with what's hurtful about it. We so often, I'm not thinking about people who are poor. I'm thinking about people who are lower middle class, you know, just getting by and so on. We so often make that condition something that's sort of shameful, as though you failed, you know, because you've got a modest life, you're somehow a failure. That people begin to hold things in, they become resentful, and the resentment makes them aggressive, and, you know, it's a natural syndrome. But I think there's a real issue in America. We simply, this is a big difference that up until the crash in 2008, everybody was in denial about, you know, and it can't be healthy.
So do you think the crash, to the extent that it maybe reset people's understandings of what makes one successful or not, sometimes it's just the vagaries of the economy, do you think the crash may have been a helpful thing?
Well, we want to say helpful.
Well, understanding that we're not happy to hear about anybody's, you know, pain and hardship.
Yeah, yeah. Well, in my book, I try to explore some of that with a group of lower level back office workers on Wall Street who became unemployed, and I interviewed, you know, the effects that the crash had on their lives, both materially and emotionally. And one of the things that I and my long-suffering students found was that people had actually become, as a result of the crash, become more tolerant of other people. It's not surprising in a way. You know, if you're having a tough time, you're not going to be snooty to other people who are having a tough time. But these were people who grew up in that Wall Street, jungle. And it was a real shock to them to discover, for instance, that people who didn't have any money, for instance, might have a high level of pride about their work. Sounds odd, doesn't it? But if you're measuring everything in terms of cash, you're kind of blind to the fact that people who don't have that cash can still take pride in their work. And we found that quite a lot from the people we interviewed, that it's like waking up to the fact of ordinary life.
Hmm.
So I wouldn't say it's, certainly no depression is ever a good thing, but I think it may dislodge some of the aggressive, that kind of overvaluation of aggression that existed in American culture during the boom.
Let's go back to the phones now. 1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Trey on the line in Arlington. Hello, Trey.
Hi there, Chris. I had a question. I'm interested in reading the book you guys are talking about. I'm a big fan of Dr. Stephen Covey's 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. I know one thing he talks about there is how, you know, independence is important, you know, to become independent, but that's the next step, is to become independent or cooperative.
You know, Trey, I'm so sorry, but the line is breaking up. We're unable to hear you. I think he wanted to ask something, Richard, about Stephen Covey's Highly Effective People. I don't know if you're familiar with the work or if you can discuss how that might relate to what you found.
I don't know the book, but what I heard before the line broke up is how does independence relate to cooperation?
Mm-hmm.
And I can tell you something psychologically about that. Maybe this isn't what Stephen wanted to get at, but I'll tell you what I know about this. We think that one form of independence, which is what psychologists call autonomy, would be opposed to cooperating with other people, that people would feel that it's like a kind of zero-sum game. The more I have to depend on you, the less I feel good about myself. And in fact, it doesn't work that way, because when you develop skills of being able to relate well to other people, you feel more self-confident, you feel more capable. And so there's a dimension of autonomy that people develop where they feel like, you know, I'm all right, I can manage, precisely because they've had that experience of being able to work well with other people.
So they're sort of empowered to both give and receive help if they happen to need it.
Yeah. And, you know, oftentimes the things that we measure, nobody, for instance, would ever think about losing autonomy if, you know, if a parent or a friend dies, you reach out to other survivors. You wouldn't think for a moment, gosh, my autonomy is in jeopardy here. But there are more socially structured situations in which we think that's the case. On the job, for instance, it's something I talk about in the book. On jobs, for instance, people get worried about covering for employees who are having a hard time, either they're depressed or they're drunk or something. You know, they're having some kind of problem. And they think that somehow they're going to lose out. If they cover for them. And that's a sign of that worry that what I give to you, I take away from myself. We shouldn't have a work world like that.
Richard Sennett is my guest. We're talking about his new book, Together, The Rituals, Pleasures, and Politics of Cooperation. We'll come back to the conversation in a moment. You can join us by emailing think@kera.org or calling 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Richard Sennett. He's distinguished visiting scholar at the University of Cambridge and emeritus professor of sociology at the London School of Economics. His new book is called Together, The Rituals, Pleasures, and Politics of Cooperation. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. That's where we hear from Jack, who writes, please suggest habits to change listening or thinking from insecurity to cooperation and teamwork?
Oh, that's a really interesting question. you know, some of it is, and it interests me for two reasons. One is that some of these habits are really simple, like learning how to keep silent when somebody says something to you that's provocative,
mm-hmm.
you know? It's just a training in self-restraint. And I try to go through a whole set of these in the book in various kinds of settings. You know, community organizers, people running voluntary organizations and the like. The other thing that's really interesting about this question is the word habit. Because that's really what cooperation is all about. It's not a kind of spontaneous, reaching out to somebody else as a kind of one-time event. Of course, we do that, you know, if a boat tips over, you're suddenly going to try and, I hope, save somebody who's drowning.
Yeah.
But normally, what we need to be good at cooperation is to do it often and to have routines for it. That's what the rituals part of my book is about. And here again, I've got a view which maybe your listeners don't share, but it's mine, which is that certain forms of religious life are really necessary for us to learn cooperation. And those are forms of religious ritual in which we don't think, do I want to do this or don't I want to do this? Giving alms, for instance, or visiting a sick neighbor or whatever. But we do it out of a sense that it's a moral obligation. In other words, we don't make a choice. And religious rituals have, both in Catholicism and Judaism and Islam, have imagined learning the habits of cooperation through practicing those sorts of rituals, where it's not a matter of choosing to help, but a matter of obligation. In my book, I try to look at the peculiar problem that early Protestantism had about this, because they were the enemies, Luther and Calvin, were the enemies of habit, the enemies of ritual. They wanted this to come by choice from within. But that's much harder to do, you know, and it's been a kind of great drama in the unfolding of Protestantism. Anyhow, that's slightly a sidebar to saying that what supports us, I think, in learning the habits of cooperation is ritual, religious observance. As I say, many of you've probably got a lot of secular listeners who may dispute the role of religion in that, but at least that's my own view of how habits of cooperation develop.
How does flexibility play into cooperation?
It can be a good thing and a bad thing. It can be a good thing if you're responsive to something particular that somebody else needs. It can be a very bad thing if what you're doing is saying, well, I'm really not going to commit. You know, I'm going to keep my options open.
Mm-hmm.
I'll help a little bit, but I don't want to be bogged down by demands the other person places on me. And that's a big, big issue in business cooperation, you know, because sometimes take risks you've got in a business venture. You've got to have the sense that somebody's going to stay the course, you know, that they're not going to be flexible in the sense of cutting out working with you when stormy weather first appears. So it's got both sides. There's an adaptive side to it, and there's a weak side to flexibility.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak next with James in Fort Worth. Hello, James.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Hey, I wanted to ask the guest, I've been doing some reading around something called the prisoner's dilemma, and it kind of involves game theory, and this is something that's been, to broaden the conversation around rather than just what goes on at work, but sort of nationally, it seems like in order for one person, in our country, there's a lot of rugged individualism, but in order for one person to win, another person has to lose. And that sort of, that individualism is actually partly what keeps us from really getting together and making some changes that would really be impactful, like clean energy or whatever. Could you kind of talk about that or how it might relate to your work?
Well, it relates a lot. And this prisoner's dilemma is, of course, something I and everybody else who gets involved in this subject has to think about. Prisoner's dilemma is basically how much do I trust? Am I going to cut my losses? And so on. And it's basically set up as, you know, the difference between win-win and win-lose kinds of games. I'm not so sure, James, I don't know, I may be wrong, but I'm not so sure that that's the problem we've got nationally, why it's so difficult for us to get things done together, that people are sort of trying to hedge their bets. And you tell me if you think I'm wrong about this, but my sense is that something sort of basic has disappeared in America, which is that Americans share a common fate. I don't get the sense here that people really feel that they've got a shared future together. And when you don't have that sense of a kind of shared common fate, it's very difficult, I think, to decide to do any one thing together. If I put it kind of more professorially, that a lot of the strength of cooperation comes from looking towards the future rather than looking towards the immediate present. And I don't think we're doing much of that. I'm old, but my parents' generation, which grew up in the Depression and fought in the Second World War, had a really strong sense of a shared destiny with other Americans. My generation, not. And I'd say the young people I teach, even less, you know? And if you don't have that long-term perspective, any particular act of cooperation, the urgency of doing it is less, you know, because it's just a transaction rather than putting a brick in place for the future.
So we've talked in past iterations of this show about the failure to think on a very long-term basis, at least from the perspective of politics, being a factor of the 2-year or 4-year or 6-year election cycles. But obviously those have been in existence for a long time in this country. What's different now that makes it harder to look toward the long-term future?
You don't want to hear this answer. Capitalism. I mean, you know, we had a long-term economy in earlier generations, whether it worked or not. You know, people were looking for long-term profits. They were looking for careers, you know, that would sustain them for over decades. They were looking for a kind of narrative for their entire lives, both at work and in the conduct of economies. And you know, we had this huge change in modern capitalism that began in the 80s, which was much more short-term in its focus. People no longer had career ladders, career paths. Businesses took their eyes off the profit, you know, long-term profit horizon and worried about short-term stock prices and so on. And to me, that seems really... That's a real fundamental shift in modern society that has radically, you know, affected our sense of staying together, being together as a people, and so on. So I don't think it's politics. I have a great prejudice about that. I don't think politics, with some noble exceptions, brings people who are very farsighted. It's not a line of work in which farsightedness gets much reward. But certainly it has to be an issue for us now with the shape we're in economically about getting the country, you know, back on track economically. You know, we may not get short-term rewards. We might have to undergo long-term, you know, some long-term pains to set right what exists now. And if we do that, my belief is that, you know, if we can get our work life sorted out, that we're going to find, oddly enough, that we're able to cooperate in other aspects of civil society, even if the politics remains in this kind of toxic combat that it is at present.
So where can we go practically to find and to join perhaps these pockets of people who are willing to work together despite differences?
Well, one thing that may sound unpalatable to you, I don't know your own politics, would be to renovate labor unions, which are should be, you know, collective forms of strengthening work life. I'm a big believer in them, and I think the decline mirrors the erosion of a sense of, you know, common destiny for a lot of workers. You could do it, and people do it, by getting more involved in local politics rather than national politics. You're much more likely in, you know, everyday face-to-face local politics, whether it's left or right, to have an experience of cooperating with other people than you are in national politics where people just want you to send a check or turn out and listen to a speech, you know? So I think there are real practical things that can be done. The problem is that they require kind of a sense of will and a belief that actually, if you join together with other people, you're going to benefit more than remaining by yourself. And that means breaking a profound cultural code that I think has developed and strengthened in the last 30 years, that basically cooperation is not as strong a force as short-term, individual, aggressive competition, you know, with others. Whenever I talk to a lot of church groups, and whenever I talk to them, people will say, well, what you're talking about is morals. But in the real world, competition, aggression, that's a much stronger force than cooperation. And I don't think that's true practically, but as long as people believe it, we're disabling ourselves.
I'm afraid we'll have to leave it there. We are out of time. Richard Sennett is Distinguished Visiting Scholar at the University of Cambridge. His new book is called Together, The Rituals, Pleasures, and Politics of Cooperation. Richard, it's been a fascinating discussion. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bilotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. And our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. You can learn more about Think, find out about upcoming programs, and download the free daily podcast at kera.org/think. Email comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.